Welcome, everyone. This is a Senate Committee on General Government and Accountability for February the 6th, and we're going to open this meeting, and we're going to start out with an adoption of rules.
Okay. Chair Riley, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today, February 6th, 2018.
Thank you. Vice Chair Thatcher moves to adopt the proposed committee rules dated today. Is there any discussion? Yes.
I think we maybe should point out some of the features of a short session committee rule as opposed to a regular session committee rule, so people are aware.
Right. And my understanding is that the only difference between a short session rules and the long session rules is that minority reports have to be announced during the committee session as opposed to the way it is in the long session, which can be later on. They have to be announced during the meeting where the bill is passed out of committee. Okay. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
So, any other discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, we adopted the rules. I think I want to have the committee and the staff introduce themselves. I'm going to start down here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Senator James Ivory Manning Jr. from the District 7, which is North and West Eugene, Junction City, and all that marvelous farm and community in between. This is my first term on a Ways and Means General Government Accountability. I am pleased to be here, and I won't hold it up with a lot of other fluff, so I'll pass it on. Thank you.
Mark Hass from the Beaverton area in Washington County. Second session on this committee.
Kim Thatcher, District 13, Senate District 13, obviously. I live in Kaiser, but my district goes up to Hillsborough.
Yes, it does. So I'm Senator Chuck Riley, and my district is Hillsborough, Corneas, Forest Grove, and North Plains. Isabel?
Isabel Hernandez, committee assistant.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cheyenne. I'm the committee staff.
Great. So we're going to go a little out of order. We're going to start with Senate Bill 1559. Senator, whenever you're ready. So I am going to open the public hearing, 1559.
Andrew, you want to come with this?
Sure. Anyone you want to bring along is fine.
Thank you, Chair Riley. For the record, I'm Senator Jackie Winters. I represent District 10, which is Monmouth, Independence, Salem, Almsville, and Turner. And I'm here today to speak to and ask for your support of Senate Bill 5559. And just for a little background, if you follow the news, it's the whistleblower bill. Recently, the Statesman Journal published an article about a employee or former employee who was employed at ODOT. And that employee had actually brought to the attention some issues that had to do with both safety as well as some mismanagement of dollars and resources. The final conclusion of it was that the individual was fired, and the individual later filed a wrongful termination and was awarded, I believe, about $95,000. You know, that caused me some real concern. Couple things. We've had the whistleblower policy in place for years. In fact, if I recall my history correctly, we did it when I was with Governor Attia. And when we did, It was done to encourage employees, not to discourage. And so I asked staff to begin looking at it in terms of what can we do to improve so that employees will not feel in any way that if they do actually come forward to actually bring to administration problems that occur, that they won't be faced with a termination. And so as a result, a couple of things that was actually pointed out, and this bill will actually address, and that is that that an employee, if they do come forward, that for most, sometimes they're in fear of identity, of being identified, and this provides an anonymity for the employee. The other thing that we found was that there is not any training. So when you come into an agency, you really don't know what your rights are or know how, you know, the reporting processes and what have you. And the bill actually addresses that particular issue. And lastly, the bill actually, we originally had talked to the Department of Justice for writing the manual, and then they kind of said, we really think it belongs to DOJ. To BOLI. So we agree that probably rightfully it does belong to BOLI. But in any event, I do think we need to have a way of saying to our employees one, you are protected when you actually bring forth a complaint, and that two, and you can be anonymous, and three, that you know what your rights are in that process. And that's the background of the bill and why I introduced the bill. I noted that there's been quite a lot of front page generated as a result of introducing this piece of legislation, and I understand that the individual who was terminated feels with this piece of legislation that he's been vindicated, you know, as a result of him bringing forth, even though he had been terminated and had to result to a lawsuit. So with that, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And if I can't answer them, I brought the expert with me.
Okay. Any questions for the senator? I see no questions. Thank you very much.
Oh, wow. Thank you. I'll go back to my other committee.
There you go. Thank you for coming. Stacy Cowan?
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. Stacy Cowan with SEIU Local 503. SEIU is a union of nearly 65,000 Oregonians doing more than 500 different jobs in 85 state, local government, and nonprofit agencies and care facilities. And I'm here today just to offer some words in support of Senate Bill 1559. SEIU has a long history of supporting whistleblower legislation and anything we can do to improve those protections. And again, I'm happy to be able to do that today with 1559. Our members have experienced firsthand retaliation that often comes from managers when workers expose misuse of tax dollars, abuse and neglect, or outright criminal activity. Senate Bill 1559 will go a long way to prevent retaliation and give workers much needed added security when they do choose to come forward. In recent years, workers at the Oregon Health Authority uncovered terrible mismanagement that led to an overhaul of the agency and improved treatment for at-risk youth. Custodial staff at the Department of Administrative Services uncovered evidence of fraudulent activity associated with a contractor that had received a sweetheart contracting deal. And then most recently, we learned about the worker that the senator spoke about at the Oregon Department of Transportation who was fired for reporting problems with worker safety and shady contracting practices. In each of these instances, even with the protection of a union contract, workers feared for their jobs and for other types of reprisal. It takes a tremendous amount of courage for someone to speak out. It's a lot to ask someone to put their livelihood on the line to do so, and many times there's significant disincentives to raise concerns. So the more that we can do to help improve these protections, the more that folks are going to be encouraged to speak out. So again, happy to support this legislation today. Thank you.
Any questions for this witness? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So before I move on, is there anybody else who wants to testify on this issue? I'm going to close the public hearing on this bill. Do we know if Senator Courtney is coming?
He's coming, but he's overdue.
Okay. So we're going to pause right now for a little bit. We're waiting for there's the senator. So we're not going to pause right now. Senator, if you join us. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1501. Whenever you're ready, Your Honor.
Chair Riley and Vice Chair Thatcher and members of the Senate Committee on General Government Accountability. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm a state senator in District 11. And I'm here today to say something good about Senate Bill 1501. Do you have that bill in front of you?
Yes, sir.
Do you know what the bill is about?
I'm waiting for you to tell me.
You weren't told it's about the state fair? It's about the state fair. So the state fair is sort of special to Peter. That's one of the main reasons it's in my district, the heart of my district. And even when I was on Salem City Council, not that you care about my past, it was in my district. So it's sort of been with me for my entire life that I've been elected official. And when I was trying to move us out of this building, because at one time we thought about retrofitting this building so it would be safe for the children to come here, because when the big earthquake hits us, and then we decided at the last second not to do it, one of the places that I decided we were going to go to was the state fair. We were going to move to the state fair. That was one of the locations we seriously looked at. We didn't finalize there. We decided to go to where the PUC is, but it all went sideways in the last 24 hours, and we didn't go there. But literally, the state fair was one of the serious locations we looked at, where the legislature would spend some 2 years, actually 2 to 3 years, while we rebuilt the state capitol. And when the summer comes, that is the one place I go every summer to lose the goat milking competition. And so there's this goat milking competition at the state fair, and a certain state representative, there's been two, one state senator, there's a goat milk, and I always lose out there, but I always go because it's one of the big events in the state fair. In 2013 session, I sponsored Senate Bill 7 to create the State Fair Council as a public corporation. And that was a last gasp effort, because we have been struggling since I've been in the building, way back, trying to deal with the state fair, because state fairs nationwide were suffering and going under, because the state simply couldn't subsidize them anymore. And so we tried a lot of different things, and finally the public corporation I grudgingly went along with, because we did at one time put it in state parks, and they said, Peter, enough of this, and so they came up with a public corporation. So that is the mode that the new world we created for the state fair. And the governor appointed the council, and they have been doing, I mean, I can tell you, I gotta give them credit, they have been doing a lot of great work out there, and it hasn't been easy. They promote that place year round, as you know. It's not just the state fair event. You got to keep it news year round. And those people on that council just been doing a great, great job. It's important to me that we continue to have strong leadership in the state fair. This bill makes small but important changes to the state fair council, including decreasing the membership from 11 to 15. That's what it is now. You can have up to 15, no less than 11, to 9. To 13, and implementing clear term limits. So they're reducing their membership on their governing body by 2. Either they got to have at least 9, but no more than 13. And you know, I think you can understand why that is important. You can have councils as good as intended, as much as they intend to do good work. They're just too cumbersome. They're too big. Most important, this bill adjusts the terms of office for all the current and future council members. This will ensure that only a third of the council terms will be up at the same time. This means there are always senior members on the council to provide the continuity to the council and preventing the entire council terms from being expiring at the same time. Now, this is a house cleaning bill. It's a bill that the State Fair Council asked me to introduce. I'd like to thank the State Fair Council for bringing forward this issue. I always also like to thank them for their incredible work on behalf of the State Fair and the State of Oregon. So that's what the bill is. It's simple, a change of the membership a bit, and also making sure that their terms don't all end at the same time. So that's what it is, and that's why I'm here.
Great. Pretty simple bill. Any questions?
I'll wait for it to pull up here. I think I did have a question. So right now I am understanding that there are no term limits, no terms of office. Is that the problem?
Chair Riley and Co-Chair Thatcher and members of the committee. I'm Lisa Herzog. I'm staff for Senator Courtney. I believe that there are currently technically term limits, but all the members serve at the pleasure of the governor, as far as I'm aware.
So
I might be wrong.
I think we'll get an answer from another witness on that knows more. So we'll.
Okay.
We'll, yeah, thanks. No,
thank you.
So any other questions? Nope. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Senator Courtney, appreciate you coming.
Thank you for allowing me to go first. Was I first?
You were.
I did not ask to go first.
That's, it was my decision. You went first.
By the way, Senator Mark has here a word I said because I was looking at him the whole time. I never looked at him one time. Can I just ask him, Chair, does he know I'm here? Would you chastise him?
So, Senator Hass, are you aware that, Senator Courtney is here? Yeah, he is.
He does. Okay, I was very concerned because he didn't look at me the whole time.
I don't blame him. But
I don't blame him.
Not a problem. Okay, Representative Berger.
For the record, Vicki Berger of Salem. Boy, do I hate following Senator Courtney. Just as a rule, it's not a good idea. Ladies and gentlemen, nice to see old friends. Nice to meet some new people up there. I was the House co-sponsor of the Senate bill that formed the Oregon State Fair Council with Senator Courtney Kiernan through the Senate. He described it pretty aptly. We were at the end of our rope as to what to do about the State Fair. We all love it, and we wanted it to continue, but it could not continue under Parks without being an incredible burden on the state resources. So we thought we would, as a last-ditch effort, try and make it a public corporation and see if it could go better under those kinds of rules. We were happily correct in that assessment. At the time that we passed the legislation, in answer to Senator Thatcher's question, the last thing we were worried about was the term limit of the council members. We were concerned with how to structure it to have the right kind of oversight and it still give it the sort of freedom to be more creative than an agency generally is. The fair is one of those activities that grows huge, enormous, and then shrinks down to nothing, where state government generally has an ongoing mission that requires ongoing resources in terms of personnel. That's not how fairs work. It's a contracting thing. You bring it all in and then you make it go away. Otherwise, you're burdened way too much. And so with that in mind, we worked very hard to try and get proper oversight, a council that worked, and see if we could get the fair off and going under this new system. I'm happy to report we were very successful. Sometimes an idea works. We have, and he's behind me, Mike Paliusak came up and is our chief operating officer, and he is a wonder and a fair professional who has taught me an awful lot about this business as a member of the council. And we are now 4 years into this feeling like we have our feet under us and our statutory mission is well in hand and the fair is a going concern. And as always, I invite you to come and see the fair or even just tour the fairgrounds during, because we have an exhibition center, as the senator has indicated, and we'd love to see you at any time. What we didn't think about was the fact that if the governor hadn't reappointed the council in December of this year, we all would have been gone, because we just said it's 4 year terms, period. Now the governor has put into her rules that it's two terms, but we statutorily didn't speak to this, Senator Thatcher. So we as a council realized that it was time for us to kind of fix this. And we had a subcommittee that met and we talked about what would be best. We liked this, the terminology that is in this bill suits us. It allows for turnover, but not too much turnover. And we just think that that's an important part of anybody. After a certain amount of terms, you are term limited out, but then you can come back after sitting out a term. I think that's standard with boards. But we want to keep our institutional knowledge, but we also want fresh ideas and fresh thoughts coming forward, and we think this is the way to get there. So it is our attempt to look like we're growing up here and we're really moving forward, and as a board that's going to continue and hopefully continue to make the state fair a huge success in our state. We appreciate your attention to this kind of housekeeping matter that we have given a lot of thought to and had some serious discussion with the governor's office about. We serve at the pleasure of the governor, and we're well aware of that, and we're not trying to get sideways of that. But we think this is the way we ought to conduct ourselves as board. Answer any other questions?
Representative Thatcher, or Senator Thatcher, sorry.
I answered to both. It's all right. There's worse names. How many active members are there on the council now, and will you be reducing, like getting rid of two?
No.
Okay.
No.
So it's
we haven't filled all of the positions we have, and we also have positions that are non-voting. Both the Senate and the House have a member that sits on our board, but they are non-voting. We also have categories where the positions have to fill certain requirements that they be in some way related to a fair industry or have certain skill sets with regard to, and that was in the original legislation too, but we are not full yet. We still have places, and but we, in fact, we had too many, and that's part of the reason why we reduced it a couple, because we don't anticipate we're going to fill to that. The members that are on the committee are active and participatory, but they're from all over the state, too. We do a lot of phone-in board meetings sometimes.
Yes.
And I guess I would wonder, how do you say, well, you're going to be out of here first? I mean, how is it going to be a lottery-type thing?
Or no, just gonna... no. Within the bill, we have identified the positions,
okay,
and everyone knows which position. They're in position one, position two, position, and the bill specifies which ones go out. And we as a board approved this, and they all know where they are in that positioning. And some people, I think, are ready to kind of move on, and others are not. I'm not. So within this legislation, we have specified position one, position two, and we know which position we hold, and we are all very good with that system.
Other questions? So thank you very much. I think this is a good bill, and I hope we can move it forward. So.
Appreciate your interest. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to close the public hearing on 1501, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1514. So, do you want to give us a little summary of 15-14 as it stands, and then I'll talk about some amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 15-14 permits legislative committees to conduct periodic sunset review of statutory boards and commissions that have been in existence for at least 6 years, directs the Legislative Policy and Research Office to develop and maintain a review schedule in consultation with the Governor's Office as specified, requires entities subject to review to provide certain information in advance to be compiled by the Legislative Policy and Research Office and reported to legislative committees, takes effect the 91st day after seeing a DA, and that is the underlying measure.
Thank you. And so there are two pending amendments. They're not on OLIS yet because they're not quite finalized. Actually, one is finalized, but it's not in OLIS yet, so we can't actually do anything with this bill. Anyway, one of those amendments will exempt the commodity councils that are not funded by the state. This makes some sense to me because they don't receive funding from the state. They all of their funding is from the agriculture or commodity that they oversee, and their folks that they do oversee are not bashful. If there's some problem, they'll let us know. So I think that's a reasonable thing to do, and so that's one of the amendments that will go in before this bill goes into effect. The other amendment will exempt those commissions that are rulemaking commissions for the agencies or supervise agencies in any way, and those we really hear a lot from those folks already. I will be looking at the reports that they make to other parts of the legislature, but I see no reason for them to report again because they already make reports and they go to Ways and Means every other year, and so those agencies won't be part of this, those commissions won't be part of this either. With that said, if there's anyone that I call who now doesn't need to talk, we'll just say thank you. I will actually start calling witnesses, and if you still want to talk, we'd love to hear from you. So I'm going to start with I'm just going to go down the list as it is here. I'm going to call three people up: Rebecca Gladstone, Ryan. Ryan Burrow, so that's what I can see, and Dana Branson.
It's Bond. My handwriting is
Bond?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Am I missing someone?
I'll speak for Dana.
So, whoever wants to start first?
My name's Ryan Bond, and I was here on behalf of the Oregon Sweet Cherry Commission and myself as a cherry farmer in the Dalles, and just wanted to say thank you for amending the bill before we even had to ask.
Well, it just made sense. So I'm glad you came, and I'd love to chat with you sometime about how your commissions work, because I know a little bit now that I didn't know a month ago. So I think that's a reasonable thing for those particular boards, agriculture-type boards. So thank you for coming in. So any questions before we go ahead?
Thank you, Chair Riley, members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Gladstone. I'm speaking on behalf of the League of Women Voters of Oregon. We support the facilitation of efficient and effective administration of government. To that end, elimination of state government entities that are no longer working actively on current vital work should be disbanded so that support staff time can be used more effectively for ongoing and more pressing work, and citizen volunteers can find more valuable areas to use their time on behalf of Oregon. In theory, we support the concept of using sunsets to cut out wasteful or outdated government bureaucracy, but we believe this bill is overbroad. and may have negative unintended consequences. First, this bill imposes on the directors of all agencies the time-consuming task of justifying work of any boards, commissions, task forces, or other entities that are meeting on behalf of these agencies. Section 2, 3, sections A through G, define criteria which must be included in the working entity's report to be compiled by the agency director every 6 years or more frequently if the reviewing committee, legislative committee, decides. Metrics for this work accomplished by some entities would be especially difficult to develop and measure and could be a burdensome distraction for a busy agency.
Could you speak up a little bit?
Oh, sometimes in this room it's too loud. You can hear me breathing. Mm-hmm. Sorry. I hope, is it better?
Yes.
Thank you. It also takes legislators valuable time from current session work. These entities are how legislation is implemented. Some work is necessarily ongoing, such as land use planning and resource management. There's a mechanism for the entire legislature to address the missions of state agencies, and the legislature can also consider whether or not certain entities should continue. Should you consider this bill, the focus should be on creating a list of entities that have not met in a regular manner, rather than a broad overview of all of them. It's most important that any process for eliminating a state entity be open and transparent to the public and to stakeholders who have a vested interest in the business of that entity. These are our concerns about the bill in its present form. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this legislation, and I'd like to add my personal thanks to Josie Kuna, our new volunteer with League of Women Voters, who did the research for the bill.
Any questions? So we did last year do what you've just said that we should do, and that is we polled all the boards and commissions and those who were no longer meeting and hadn't met for some time and honestly couldn't find a member. We deleted from the ORS. They no longer are boards and commissions. This is meant to delve in a little bit farther. We expect that most boards and commissions that we look at are doing great work. But I take oversight very seriously, and I think that it's important that we take care of our taxpayer dollars. And so from what I've been able to figure out, no one is looking at boards and commissions to see if they're actually still doing what they were designed to do, and if they're doing it efficiently and using our taxpayer dollars well. That's my goal. I suspect that those who aren't meeting that criteria, once they've been asked to report, probably will start doing that, and that's my hope. So that's the goal of this. It isn't to get rid of anybody. It's to make sure that our taxpayer dollars are spent well and that the boards and commissions that the legislature has set up are still doing what the legislature intended for them to do. So thank you very much for your testimony, and I appreciate what you have to say. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, Heath Curtis, Tammy Denis, and Roger Beyer.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. It's a pleasure to speak for you the first time in the short session here. As a reminder, OFIC represents Oregon's large timber landowners and forest products manufacturers. I very much appreciate your representations regarding the amendments you're working on. There are some large boards and commissions that we work with literally on a daily basis that I think subjecting them to a process like this could be inefficient and onerous and for little return on investment. And I think hearing your You talk about this earlier. I think we're on the same page. Those specifically, though, would include that I can think of off the top, you know, the Board of Forestry, the Department of the Board of Agriculture, the Environmental Quality Commission, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission. So, you know, these are bodies that we interface with regularly that we think are, I don't think anybody is seriously proposing that they be disbanded. So with that, we will look carefully at the language that you propose. There are a number of bodies of different types that are funded through landowner dollars, and we'll look at the amendment when it comes out on the commodity commissions.
Great, and I'm hoping that if we miss something that you think shouldn't be there, you'll let us know.
It's my job, Senator.
Yes.
Thank you. Very good.
Go ahead.
Chair Riley, members of the committee, my name is Tammy Denny. I am the legislative director for the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, located here in Salem, serving all of the 200 plus dairies across the state, small and large, conventional and organic. So we're really happy to hear of the amendment and look forward to reading that amendment in length. The Oregon Dairy Products Commission, which happens to be located in Portland, is governed by not only producers, but processors, and then a public member. They are then overseen by statute from the Department of Agriculture and very well monitored, and those reports then from the contractors that the Dairy Products Commission engage with, all of those dollars are closely monitored and very well managed. So any additional oversight would be a duplication and would be inefficient. These are all producer and processor dollars, so no state dollars are funding this effort for the processing of fluid milk, which comes from our dairy farms. So wanted to say thank you publicly to you and members of the committee for hearing us and as we raise this concern, and thank you. We look forward to seeing the amendment. Thank you again.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon Seed Council and also the Oregon Blueberry Producers. The Oregon Seed Council has four commissions that are members of it. So obviously we took this very seriously when the bill was introduced. I look forward to seeing the amendments. I've talked to all of you on the committee, and Chair Riley, I appreciate your willingness to entertain these amendments to exempting commodity commissions that are not receiving funding from the state. We will look at them very closely and make sure the wording is as we think it needs to be to make sure that it takes care of that issue. Also like to reiterate what Heath Curtis said about boards and commissions of state agencies, and appreciate your comments. I think, again, we have to make sure the wording is right because there are both boards and commissions, the Board of Forestry and the Fish and Wildlife Commission, the Board of Ag, and the Environmental Quality Commission, so we need to make sure that that amendment exempts both boards and commissions, not just commissions. So we will look closely when we see those amendments, and we will certainly let you know if we don't think they get the job done that we think needs done.
Thank you very much. As I've said to you individually and some other folks, I've learned a lot about boards and commissions over the last 2.5 years. It's been an interesting study. And I think that I'll learn even more over the next couple of years. So. Yes, Senator Linthicum.
Just a question with regard to the amendment process. In the commodities section, ORS 576.062, there's 21 commodity commissions listed there. It's my understanding that there are more than 300 commissions and boards within the governmental enterprise for the state of Oregon.
Yeah.
That means there's only 21 documented here, and there's a whole, you know, boondoggle full of them in some
right.
other shoebox.
Exactly.
And I'm curious how legislative council is slicing and dicing to find those that we want to include and omit those that we are excluding purposefully.
Right, and it's fairly straightforward. If it's a commodity board or commission that does not receive state funding for its major funding, and I'm not talking about one-time grants, then they are exempt from this by that amendment. The other amendment very specifically calls out those boards and commissions which are agency boards and commissions and do agency work, oversight or rulemaking, any agency work. And that cuts out another 50 probably. And so we'll be looking at probably 150 over a rotating basis, once every 6 years, just the way we do tax credits.
Just a follow up, if I may. For example, wheat's not there. Does, you know, how do you classify commodity as commodity in terms of that nomenclature?
Yeah. So if it's commodity based, and wheat is a commodity.
Right. Well, I'm wondering about the definition as well.
Yeah, and we may not have that worked out right, and that's what I'm hoping that that these folks will help me with if the wording's not right. But the intention is to exclude the wheat commission because they're not funded by the state. They're funded by the wheat growers. As I said earlier, I think the wheat growers will let us know if there's a problem. And as Mr. Beyer pointed out to me earlier today, there's been at least one board which came to them and said, we don't need you to exist anymore. And they came and we took them out of the ORS. So I think that's a process that we can continue for those boards. And I think that does that answer your question as best I?
It does. I'm fine. I got potatoes, alfalfa, and dairy. I'm good to go.
Okay, there you go. Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We've got two more folks, Jim James and Joe Reitiger. I'm sure I said it wrong, but you can correct me.
It's really
absurd. Thank you.
I'll start. Just so you know, my name is Joe Rollator, and I represent four commodity commissions that are the Ocean Fisheries Commodity Commissions. And those would be the Oregon Dungeness Crab Commission, the Oregon Trawl Commission, the Oregon Albacore Commission, and of course the Oregon Salmon Commission. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we. Thank you very much. In fact, one of my directors just emailed me back saying, with its little sign that had a thumbs up sign, we appreciate that very much. I want to echo what Heath Curtis said, though, that we really find it's important to work almost daily with the agency commissions. And for instance, Fish and Wildlife Commission is paid for mostly with fishing and hunting fees and federal funds that are related to fishing and hunting fees. And fishermen really like to argue. And if we didn't have the Fish and Wildlife Commission to go and argue at, we would really be lost. The other night, the last commission meeting, the last 3 hours of the meeting, and this is from 5 o'clock at night until 8 o'clock at night, we argued amongst ourselves and with the commission on how rockfish quotas would be allocated and also how each particular kind of fishery, from a hook and line commercial fishery to a hook and line sports fishery, would be allocated the days that we could fish, and that really affects how valuable our commodity is. And so we really appreciate the Fish and Wildlife Commission. We argue about it all the time, but thank you very much for leaving him out of this bill. Thank you.
So I'm a fisherman, and my brother-in-law is a fisherman, and we argue all the time too. So.
Excellent. That's very healthy.
I understand. And you may actually talk about seals sometimes. So, any questions?
I have no comment.
Okay. Go ahead.
Chair Riley, Co-Chair Thatcher, and members of the General Government and Accountability Committee. My name is Jim James. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Small Woodland Association, an organization that represents the 140,000 family woodland owners in the state. 42% of the state's private forests belong to family woodland owners. And first of all, I would applaud your goal for efficient government. And I'm pleased to hear about the amendments that you've suggested. And it sounds to me like those amendments will cover my concerns with this original bill. But I will take the opportunity to highlight an example I intended to use in my original testimony, which is the Board of Forestry. Again, the Board of Forestry is appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate, and they have terms. There's rules and regulations of how they operate. In my opinion, they've been extremely effective forever since the Board of Forestry was created. And I did have a grave concern that this bill had the potential to derail some of that effectiveness, particularly in the directions that a Oregon Department of Forestry. So I'm very pleased with the amendments. I look forward to taking a look at those. And thank you for taking that into consideration. Thank you.
Questions? So I have, I don't have any forest owners in my district, but just outside my district, I have several. And I work with them just as if they were in my district. Sure. And the small woodland owners are in a good group of people, and I really appreciate that you're here representing
them. Thank you. So, in fact, I'll take this opportunity. One reason why I enjoy the position I have is there's no finer people in the world than family woodland owners. They are really a great group of folks. So thank you for those comments. I appreciate it.
Senator Manning.
Mr. Chair, thank you so much, and thank you for coming forward. In my district, I have a number of families that own tree farms and things like that. So thank you for representing my district as well.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So that ends the testimony on 1514. I'm going to close that public hearing. And I'm going to open a public hearing on 1545. Do you want to tell us what that's about?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1545 apportions the cost of state court technology provided to state agencies based on each agency's number of full-time equivalent positions beginning July 1st, 2019. It specifies the parameters for the Department of Administrative Services and the Judicial Department and takes effect the 91st day after assignee die. This has a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee also.
You must be Phil.
I am, Senator. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Introduce yourself and go ahead and read the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Lemon. I'm with the Oregon Judicial Department. I represent your state courts. This bill is about fairly allocating the cost of running a statewide court technology system. We want to thank you again and remind you that we successfully implemented the Oregon eCourt system statewide in 2016. One of the main improvements in that from the access to justice standpoint was allowing litigants to electronically file their pleadings into state courts and also setting up a system where you can have a subscription and log in and obtain access to court pleadings. And so that has been a major benefit to Oregonians and litigants in the courts. On the private sector side, people pay filing fees, statutory filing fees that you establish, and a percentage of those goes into the State Court Technology Fund to fund the e-filing and other system support costs. Those are things like civil litigation, employment contracts. It can be family law, small claims, and landlord-tenant litigation, so the full range of private sector litigation. We also have about 3,500 private entities that pay subscription fees to get remote access to court information. So these are primarily attorneys, but also include landlord tenants, people doing background checks, private investigators, news media, title companies, anybody who wants regular and needs regular access to court information, and this is a very efficient way of providing that. And so the Chief Justice establishes subscription fees for those private sector users that are reviewed through the state budget process as you look through the OJD budget. But we do not charge public sector users for that.
And so, and part of that, we wanted to align with the state statute that does not charge statutory court filing fees to public sector litigants. That includes in criminal cases, but also in civil cases brought by cities, counties, state government, either as a plaintiff or a defendant. And then similarly, we do not charge them for what this, our remote document access is called OJSIN, the Oregon Judicial Case Information Network. We do not charge them subscription fees for their access to that. And that is proving to be a real challenge in managing our system, and also a matter of fairness between how we allocate those costs between the public sector and the private sector. So what this bill would do, if it's successful, we would work with the Department of Administrative Services to develop a state agency assessment that would get built into the budget development process for 1921. And so we're looking at recovering about $2.4 million in costs that we can directly attribute to state agencies in terms of their share of electronic filings into our both trial, tax, and appellate courts, and also the about 4,000 individual users from a variety of state agencies who have OJSIN access. That the primary users of OJSIN are child welfare workers and DHS. We have about 600 in the Department of Justice, both in the litigation side and the child support side, but it covers the whole gamut from Department of Transportation, DMV, Legislative Council, Secretary of State audits, employment, revenue. It runs a whole range. So we would, I'd be glad to answer any questions you may have, but that's the concept and what we have before you today.
Great. Questions?
Mr. Chair, I do have a few questions, but I'll have to do this separate one if I could. My question would be, who is going to maintain the database? Because we have been going through a number of things with a chief information officer, technical officer here at the state level, and DAS, and there are several others that are doing kind of their own thing. So would this be maintained by the courts, or would this fall under the chief information officers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Manning, this is the case information system for the entire state court system. And as a separate branch, we have an independent set of technologies. We are on the state CIO council. We coordinate closely, but we are not under their immediate jurisdiction. Did that answer your question?
Yes. Thank you.
Sir Lampkin, you mentioned, if you can help me clarify, you mentioned the $2.5 million, and then in terms of revenue collection, I wasn't sure if that was from the public sector, from the private sector, both combined. How does that relate?
Senator Riley, Senator Lampkin, the 2.4 is the estimated amount that we would be asking to put into the state agency assessment in the 1921 biennium. In terms of the, was your question, how much do we get from filing fees and the user subscriptions on the private sector side?
Currently, you're getting fees from the private sector, and the public sector's writing scot-free, and you're trying to balance the scales a little. In the 2.4, 2.5 number that I used, I'm wondering which pocket is that? Is it the whole, what is your overall budget and the revenue source for that budget?
I'll give you an answer, and I'll confirm this and get back to you if I'm not correct with my staff later.
And I'm thinking about, not only is there the OJSIN, OJSIN, whatever your nomenclature is for that judicial piece, but there's e-court, which is another part, and the district attorneys are using the court system and all of those features. You're funding that some way, and it's not just being funded by records requests.
Mr. Chair, Senator, let me give you a quick answer, and then I'll probably want to follow up in a little more detail. We have a state court technology fund, which was established by the legislature, which pays the costs of maintaining and operating our technology systems. And I believe that's about $21.6 million per biennium. And so the legislature allocates a percentage of filing fees that are collected by the courts to go directly into the technology fund that pays for a portion of that. The OJSIN fees, the subscription fees that I'd mentioned, also provides a portion of that. Last session, the legislature authorized moving a portion of criminal fine account money. So this is fines collected from state and local courts for crimes and violations, things like traffic tickets, and that we got about $3.1 million as an allocation to cover the local public safety side of that. So we provide free access to chiefs of police, sheriff's offices, community corrections. The leg of the stool that we don't have covered is the state agencies. And so that's what this bill would do.
Okay.
Did that answer your question?
That's close enough. It's, okay. I realize it's quite complicated, and we could have another meeting.
Okay.
Thank you.
Be glad to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh.
Yeah, no, that's right.
Okay.
I'll talk to you later.
So that brings us to the end of that one. We're going to close that public hearing. And we have one thing left, and that's Senate Bill 1565, and I'm going to open a public hearing on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1565 directs the Department of Justice, of Justice, Transportation, and Administrative Services to develop electronic procurement system rules that at a minimum designate a particular system, specify when state agencies must use it, and address access. It requires state contracting agency and allows a contracting entity that is not a state agency to conduct procurement, pursuant to such rules. It requires state contracting agencies to weight proposed contract prices at least 30% of the total weight given to all factors in final evaluation of proposals. Provides for a waiver of the weighting requirement if it's determined to be in the agency's best interest. Requires written notice and explanation if such waiver is provided to DAS. Directs DAS to establish a pilot project to evaluate the reverse auction method as defined, specifies minimum parameters of such project, and requires a written report to the governor and legislature by December 31st, 2019. It allows rulemaking and other activity in advance of the operative date of January 1st, 2019, and sunsets the pilot project January 2nd, 2020. It's effective the 91st day after sine die. There are two amendments pending. One requires agencies to comply with a reverse auction pilot by an operative date and with the e-procurement system rules by June 30th, 2021. And it replaces a written reporting requirement with a regular reporting to the Joint IT Committee beginning on the same date. And it sunsets the 30% weight requirement on January 2nd, 2020. That is, it incorporates the 30% weight requirement into the pilot project. Second amendment permits or exempts the Secretary of State's office and the Treasurer from having to report their waivers to DAS. It has a joint referral also, a joint referral, subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Leslie, Mary Leslie. And anyone you want to bring along.
Well, good afternoon. My name is Barry Leslie, and I'm the Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Kate Brown. Thank you for having me and Debbie Dennis, who's the statewide procurement officer, here today. We were with you in January, so we appreciate being able to come back here in February and talk to you about what is actually a very exciting concept again. Debbie and I like to joke that when we talk to people about state purchasing, they kind of get glazed over, and it's not the most exciting of topics. But I think when you hear about the amount of money the state agencies spend on buying stuff, you'll actually see why we think it's such an important topic. Just a teeny tiny bit of history. When I started working for the governor almost a year ago, she told me that one of my top priorities was going to be working with state agencies to help them find ways of saving money, saving time, and just operating government more efficiently. And so as I've been, you know, working really closely with agency directors and experts like Debbie on how we manage state government operations, and it helps that I've worked in state government for 20 years, so I kind of understand how things work. One of the things that's come up over and over again is that we don't really track how we buy stuff, and we don't really give purchasing officers across the enterprise the tools they need to be able to try to save money when they're buying stuff. And so as we've been looking into this issue, we discovered that the state spends $8 billion a biennium, which, as you all know, is about almost 10% of the all funds budget, on buying stuff. And we think that through this bill, which provides three different ways for us to do a better job of managing that state spend, that we can actually give state procurement people the tools and resources that they need to be able to do a better job and to hopefully actually save time and ultimately save money. So that's what we're going to talk to you about today. The first tool of the three that we're going to talk about is an e-procurement system. And put really simply, this is a way for agencies to use one system that actually tracks all of the ways that they are spending money. So it will track that $8 billion and tell you and capture how it's being spent. I think the reason being able to capture the spending that's done by each agency is so important is that if you're like me, and you've ever had to kind of think, where is my money going every month? And how am I doing a good job in budgeting my personal finances? You know that any finance coach will tell you that the first thing to do is to actually figure out where your money is going and to write it all down and then to develop a budget. Right now, we can't do that. We can't actually tell you where that $8 billion is going. And I am confident that as legislators, you would want to know where that $8 billion is going. And so this e-procurement system actually provides agencies with a tool to be able to track that spending. The good news is that in 2015, a group of really dedicated purchasing officials got together and said, there's got to be a better way to do this. This is just terrible the way we're doing things now. And they really did the heavy lifting of coming together as a team and finding an e-procurement solution that actually satisfies the requirements for all state agencies. They even went so far as to get their project approved through the chief information officer, and they're at the stage gate 3 conditional approval now, which, as this group knows, is really important. So I'm going to turn it over to Debbie to tell you a little bit more about that $8 billion and why the e-procurement system is important.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Riley and members of the committee. My name is Debbie Dennis, and I work at DAS as the state's chief procurement officer. So as Barry mentioned, we do know how much money is being spent. We don't know a lot about where it's being spent or how fast it's being spent or by who it's being spent. On the screen here, we have developed a graphic. The blue section at the bottom is what we know about pretty confidently. This is about $1 billion that's spent each biennium under our statewide price agreements. So every quarter, the vendors that have a statewide price agreement report to us what has been purchased and by who. And so we have pretty good understanding of that particular part of our business. The part that's less clear is the other $7 billion. We know how much is being spent on spots cards, but we don't know what people are buying with the spots cards. We know the vendor, but we don't know the items. We know that 50,000 purchase orders are being issued every year, but we don't know what's on those purchase orders. Those are not in a central system, and so we have no idea what agencies are buying on those purchase orders. We also have our current system, which is ORPAN, and we know that there are millions of dollars of contracts that are awarded and publicly noticed in that system. So that gives us quite a bit of information, but what it doesn't give us is the actual spend. When those contracts are awarded, there's an estimated amount that's entered into the system that we have today, but we don't know the rate of spend under those contracts or whether that money was actually spent or what the progress is of those contracts.
So as I mentioned, we have really a three-part solution here. The e-procurement system, which we can adopt statewide as an enterprise solution for all agencies to be able to track and manage the spending. We want to talk to you about a reverse auction pilot and also changing the way agencies evaluate the criteria they use when they are reviewing requests for proposals. So in other words, reviewing opportunities that people have to work with the state and the weight that they give pricing when they're doing that review. So I mentioned the e-procurement solution, and I mentioned already that it's already gone through Stage Gate 3 approval. We have 10 state agencies that are working on this pilot project, and it's well underway. You should also know that these agencies, as part of this pilot project, got together and did a request for proposal and ran a competitive process to go out and search out this vendor. And this vendor is used by a handful of other states and jurisdictions across the country. So they're a well-thought-of e-procurement vendor.
Okay. So another thing we wanted to talk briefly about is making sure that we are communicating clearly about what we mean by an e-procurement system. One could believe we have an e-procurement system today, and that's ORPIN. And like I mentioned, that system is primarily used to publicly notice any bidding opportunities that are available in the state of Oregon, and then also publicly notice the contract awards that have been made. An e-procurement system that's more modern would have end-to-end functionality. So what that would mean is when a person at their desk has a need for an item or a service, they would be able to enter the system, push a few buttons, identify what they need, and then that workflow for approval would be routed to the appropriate approvers within their agency, and it would ultimately land in the procurement department to begin some sourcing activity. Those are functions that are done manually and on paper today. And so then once the procurement is done, it would kind of pick up the functionality that we have within ORPIN today and then provide some back-end functionality where invoices could be matched up to the contracts. It would interface with our current financial system to be able to make payments, and information would pass back and forth between the two systems so that we could actually look up any contract and see how many payments have been made and for what. Another piece of functionality that we would get with the system that we don't have today is online catalogs for our price agreements. And so those would be uploaded by the vendor, and folks would be able to shop from our price agreements in a much more streamlined fashion. One of the biggest complaints we get about our price agreements today is that it's hard to find them in ORPIN because of the search functionality. And once they find them, it's a little bit difficult to figure out what's available because the price agreements are so long, and the system we have doesn't allow searchability by item or by service. It's also provides some vendor self-service. So vendors are able to go in and register, update their profile. They can submit their bids to us through the system rather than dropping off boxes at our front desk. They can also check the status of things rather than having to give us a call. Let's see here. And the biggest thing that it provides to us is data. And so if we had the system in place, we would have information about where that $8 billion is going. We were before you, like Barry said, several weeks ago, and we talked a lot about what we're talking about today. There are a lot of benefits of implementing a modern e-procurement system. I'm not going to go through all of these bullet by bullet because we have talked about them, but the efficiencies that an e-procurement system would bring to the state are enormous. Like I said, each agency is doing some of this functionality in a manual and paper processed environment right now. And so this would bring streamlined functionality and also consistency to the way that each agency is conducting their procurements. It would, let's see here. It's available 24/7, so vendors who are small and who are out in the field and doing their work during the day would be able to access the system after hours if needed so that they could find the information that they need to do business with the state. There's a lot of transparency in putting together an e-procurement system. Not only is it data that's transparent to the state, but the public, yourselves, vendors can also log into the system and be checking on things at your leisure. One of the main things we want to talk with you about is the way that we would like to fund the system. The vendor that that we have selected has proposed a public-private partnership for funding the system. Under this model, there would be no upfront cost to the state except for our independent QA and a couple of staff members that we would need in order to implement the project. The vendor would cover all upfront costs for implementing the system, and then there would be a transaction fee applied to the purchases under the statewide price agreements. So we've put the diagram up again because this part can get a little bit confusing. But that blue part at the bottom, the statewide price agreements, that's the place where the 1% fee would be attached. And so for every vendor that sells an item under a statewide price agreement, they would be billed 1% of their sale, and that would go to the e-procurement vendor. And then that revenue would be shared back between the vendor and the state. Once the vendor has recouped their initial investment, the share, the percentage of share, modifies over time so that the state is receiving more of that revenue and the vendor is receiving revenue that would be requisite to covering any ongoing costs they have for supporting our program. There are some benefits. It's an unusual model, but there are some benefits for us to consider funding the system through that model. One of the first benefits is that we would be able to implement an end-to-end solution without any outlay of cash by the state up front. That incents the vendor to implement a successful project because they don't get paid until it's working and until state agencies are actually able to make their purchases under the system. Another big piece is that the vendor provides a lot of support services under this model that traditionally we would have to either pay for incrementally or staff up to provide ourselves or outsource to another vendor. So some of those things include user training. They would provide ongoing user training, so I wouldn't have to add anyone to my staff in order to train new agency users that come on board, for example. They would also upload all those price agreement catalogs into the system and keep them maintained for us so that, again, that wouldn't be something that our office would, it wouldn't be a new skill set that our office would have to learn how to do. They also would provide vendor support for the life of the agreement for the vendors interacting with the system. The other big benefit to this public-private partnership is the license that the state receives. So typically when we license for a statewide system, that's for all state agencies to be able to access the system. Under this model, all public entities in Oregon would be able to implement the end-to-end solution at no out-of-pocket cost for them, except for maybe some specific integrations they might have with their financial systems. So this means schools, cities, counties, any other public entity in Oregon could implement the same system as the state and work in the same system as the state.
Before you before you move on, what's the length of that agreement, that contract?
For the entire system, or are you speaking specifically about the sharing of the revenue?
I'm talking about the public-private partnership.
Right. That would be absolutely negotiable, and so we have some preliminary information from the vendor today. We have not entered into any sort of negotiation with them about how that share would modify over time or the length of the time. That is one of the reasons we have built in the one of the amendments to the bill is for us to have periodic updates with the Joint Legislative Committee on Information Technology, and that's one of the things we would want to be communicating about as we progress through that negotiation.
Right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, Debbie has really talked about the meat of our presentation, which is bringing this e-procurement solution to Oregon agencies. But we thought this would also be a good time to bring a couple of additional tools for agency procurement officers. And the first one of those tools is really interesting. It's a pilot. So it's really the opportunity to investigate this tool for the next 18 months or so and see if it works for Oregon. So it's a real low-risk opportunity, to be honest with you. What it does is it's very similar to what you probably know about or think about as eBay. If you're putting a request for proposal on the street, let's say you have 10 folks bid for that opportunity, then you evaluate those bids and you take from that 10 whatever group actually qualifies and meets all of the criteria that you'd want from anybody that you're going to have to work with. And then in real time, you actually have, let's just say that 7 ended up qualifying. Those 7 bidders compete against each other in a real live auction format. And then the state actually chooses, assuming that the auction is successful, chooses the lowest price among those bidders. From initial research has demonstrated this has been really effective in a lot of cities and counties and states across the country. And that on average, when you do an auction like this, you can save 25 to 30% above what was spent last time by that jurisdiction. So this is an opportunity for us to try this tool and just see if it's another way to save money for taxpayers. We think that anything that actually just gives us the chance to evaluate whether or not we can save taxpayer dollars is probably worth trying out, especially when we're talking about billions of dollars a year that we're spending in terms of, you know, purchasing things for the state.
To be clear, when you say reverse auction, what you're saying is that the next bid will be lower, not higher.
Yes, that's the reverse part.
Chair Riley, thank you. Yes, good clarification. And then the last tool that we want to describe is the opportunity for purchasing managers throughout the state to use price as a tool in evaluating, again, qualified bids. So again, if you have a group of 10 people who are competing for state business and five of them are qualified, you would use price as 30% of the evaluation criteria when you're evaluating those bids. Right now, there's no requirement for agencies to use price, and our survey of agencies tells us that they use price at about 5 to 15% of the evaluation criteria. I think this is important for two reasons. One, I think it sends a signal to vendors that price matters, that we actually care about saving taxpayer dollars and we want to do our best with them, and that although it's not the only criteria and it's not even the most important criteria because it's well below 50%, that it is actually important to us how much we're spending, and that we expect folks to bring their most competitive bids when they're going to be when we're going to be paying for those bids with taxpayer dollars. So that's, again, just another tool for state procurement officers to use to help reinforce the idea that price is important, and also that they are able to use that tool in their final analysis of the bid. So that completes our presentation, and we'd just be delighted to answer any of your questions.
Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. I'm hoping we get a copy of that, first of all.
You should have it.
Oh, I don't see it on here yet. Anyway, but it'll be coming. Great. I just want to make sure that maybe I'm clear on what you're talking about, the vendor, meaning the big V vendor, the one actually setting up the system and orchestrating this whole thing. Then there are the vendors participating in the vendor. So when you talked about the 1%, say that again. I wasn't sure. Really tracking on that.
Absolutely. So co-chair, or Chair Riley and Senator Thatcher, the way the 1% works is that so our vendor for the system, let me start there, it's Periscope is the name of that firm. So I'll use that instead of the word vendor to keep the two separate. So Periscope would bill all of our vendors that have price agreement sales on a monthly basis. They would invoice them for 1% of whatever they sold under the price agreements. And then that revenue that Periscope would collect would be shared back, some of it with the state. And their initial proposal to us is that it would start at a 90-10 share until a time that came that they had recouped most of their initial investment. And then the share back would start shifting so that it would be more equitable, and their share would cover basically their operating costs with a little bit of profit, and then the state would receive the rest. Is that more clear?
That is more clear. I'm getting who is actually paying it, but if it's okay.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so 1% of $100,000.
It's a billion. So 10 million is.
No, well, I'm just saying 1% of $100,000 would be a lot more, obviously, than 1% of $1,000.
Yes.
Is there. Okay, so they're going to be somebody's going to be getting this money, the state agency and the Periscope. Is the platform so different between like large bids versus smaller bids that it would, that 1% should be carried through? I guess I can see, you know, there's a lot bigger chunk of money for the same, I guess, same amount of work is what I'm saying. And was there any differentiation between, you know, little, little tiny bids? Is it more hassle to deal with smaller stuff and therefore maybe the larger bids, since they're larger, could be reduced a little bit? I don't know. Were there any discussions that direction?
That hasn't been discussed. What we have discussed is that the fee would be a constant across the portfolio, but there would be some where we would actually not charge a fee because there are some things that we have price agreements for that just either the market doesn't bear an additional 1%, or it's a volatile pricing, like fuel is one of those, that it bounces around, and so applying the 1% would be complicated. That isn't so your question, the answer to that is we haven't considered that, but it's something that I can take back and think about if that would be a more equitable way to share the fee.
Yes, certainly. One thing that may be good that you're seeing in this, Senator Thatcher, is the governor's leaning towards a flat tax.
True that.
The question that I have with regard to it's twofold. One with regard to ranking and using price, for example, as a high ranking versus the 30% or 5% rank that it is today. Use it at 30%, and then with regard to that. The 1% fee that actually comes from, quote, vendors who are supplying products, it's not coming from state agencies. It's getting tacked onto those vendors who have won contracts or purchase agreements of some variety. So there's an added cost to them. Now, if we have smaller organizations, you know, woman-owned, minority-owned, those kinds of things, they will not be in a you know, great position to have an extra 1% tacked on to them that's buying something for the state. They wanted to win a contract to earn, you know, their own way to prosperity. And now the state's riding on their backs as they pay Periscope for the, you know, the vendor agreement that the state has with Periscope. And with regard to them being small on the end, that 1% is a large chunk of their operating budget, and for the larger vendors, it's a very small chunk of their operating budget. So I'm wondering how that got weighed, how you scaled through that, and the decisions that warranted your flat 1% across all organizations, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. So first of all, we still have a lot of ability to make decisions on which price agreements the 1% applies to. And one of the things we've discussed is whether it makes sense if a firm is certified in Oregon as a minority-owned, women-owned, emerging small business, veteran-owned, any one of those certifications that Oregon offers, we have the ability to say they don't pay the 1%. So that comes with pros and cons, and so it is something that we still have under consideration, and that would be part of our negotiation that we would be pressing forward. Another thing to think about is that at the time that they place their bid, they would know that this 1% cost would be a cost of doing business with the state. So while we are not necessarily charging the 1% to the agencies, it is possible that when a firm places their bid, they would be accounting for that in the pricing that they give to us. So I think those are the considerations that we've thought of so far.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Thank you very much.
This is a
good presentation.
Thank you.
So I'm going to close this public hearing. Anything for the good of the order? We're adjourned.